Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man with a closet full of guns and a freezer full of meat, but he's fresh out of toilet paper. He is the captain.
No poo-poo paper for you, my friend. It's good to be seen and good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
This week, we are very, very excited to be featuring one of my favorite beers. We have featured this before, but there is great cause to bring it back. Ladies and gentlemen, trumpets, please. 5 out of 5 bottle caps for Dortmunder Gold from my friends at the Great Lakes Brewing Company. This is an award-winning flagship lager that now, as of just this month, is available in a beautiful 12-ounce and 16-ounce cans. My, how we have come a long way, and today we are toasting with one of our favorites to some of our favorites. First up, cheers to Amber in Humble, Texas. Amber says the beer that she's buying, that she's providing to the Beer Fund Captain, is for you because of your awesome takedown of Scott Peterson.
The cheating turtle. Yeah, Scott, the piece of shit, Peterson. And a big shout out to Christy in Melbourne, Australia.
Next up, we have Jennifer in Salem, New Hampshire.
And a big shout out to Lori in Dallas, Texas.
Next up, we have Emily in Chicago. And last but certainly not least, a big cheers and thank you to Catherine in Orlando, Florida. Everyone we just mentioned went to truecrimegarage.com and contributed to this week's beer fund. And for that, we thank you.
Yeah, we thank you. And thanks for joining us. We know it's tough times. It's tough here in the garage. Keep your distance. Keep your distance, Colonel, or I'll sock you in the mouth, and that's enough of the business.
All right, everybody, gather around at a safe distance. Grab a chair.
Not too close.
Grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. The murders of Stevie Branch, Christopher Byers, and Michael Moore, all just 8-year-olds, was the genesis of a triple homicide case that is typically known today as the West Memphis Three. However, the phrase West Memphis Three refers to the three teenagers convicted of killing the three little boys. On May 5, 1993, in a town west of Memphis, and appropriately named West Memphis, Arkansas, the 3 8-year-old boys were reported missing. Initial police searches that night were limited. A more thorough search for the boys began the next morning at 8 a.m. After 1 p.m., the boys were found, but not to a good end. All were dead, found submerged in muddy creek water. Each boy had been stripped, and what has been commonly referred to as hogtie, each with shoelaces belonging to the boys. The drainage ditch contained 2 of the children's bikes and the clothing that the boys were wearing when last seen alive. The clothing was mostly turned inside out and twisted around sticks and stuck in the mud below the surface water. The Frank Peretti autopsies indicated that Christopher died from multiple injuries and possibly bled to death, and Stevie and Michael died from multiple injuries and drowning. They were murdered. The bodies and evidence concealed in the muddy waters, located in a small patch of woods known as Robin Hood Hills. Almost 1 month later, on June 3rd, at 2:44 in the afternoon, Detective Brian Ridge and Inspector Gary Gitchell got 17-year-old Jesse Miskelly to confess to being involved in the murders. A confession filled with inconsistencies, errors, certain statements that go against some of the very basic known facts of this case. Jesse implicated 16-year-old Jason Baldwin and 18-year-old Damian Eccles as the assailants, rapists, and murderers of the three boys. The next morning, at a press conference announcing the arrest of the three teenagers, Inspector Gitchell was asked by a reporter, "On a scale of 1 to 10, how solid do you feel your case is?" Gitchell smiled and replied, 11. Legendary FBI profiler John Douglas later called this moment that golden nugget of law enforcement theater. In 1994, the three teens were convicted of the murders. David Burnett was the presiding judge. Damian Eccles was sentenced to death. Jason Baldwin was sentenced to life imprisonment. And in a separate trial, Jesse Miskelly Jr. was sentenced to life in prison plus two 20-year sentences. The HBO documentary, Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills, documented the case and the two trials. The now famous film, which was followed by parts 2 and 3, inspired justice advocates to unite and take action. An army was formed. Men and women, some of them celebrities, some of them from far away, all united for one common cause: to free the West Memphis Three. But if the West Memphis Three were innocent, then who committed the murders? Many, after watching the documentaries, grew suspicious regarding two of the parents, Christopher's adoptive father, John Mark Byers, and Stevie Branch's stepfather, Terry Hobbs. Both looked guilty for different reasons. Following a successful decision regarding newly produced DNA evidence, the West Memphis Three negotiated a plea bargain with prosecutors. In August of 2011, they entered Alford pleas, which allowed them to assert their innocence while acknowledging that the prosecutors had enough evidence to convict them. After having served 18 years and 78 days in prison, Judge David Laser accepted the pleas and sentenced the three to time served, and they were released. In a packed courtroom, Judge Laser spoke from the bench. Quote, "I am aware of the controversy that's existed. I'm aware of the involvement of the people in this case. I don't think it will make the pain go away to the victim families. I don't think it will take away a minute of the 18 years that these three young men served in the Arkansas Department of Corrections. What I just described is tragedy on all sides. And I commend the people in the case that have assisted toward the end of seeing that justice is served to the best that we can do." It took nearly 20 years to right just some of the many wrongs in this case. But somewhere along the way of this long journey that took the valiant efforts of so many, something was lost and almost forgotten. The three little boys that were killed and lost their lives that day. The families of these three will never get them back. So this is not the best we can do, because there is still time to get justice for Stevie, Christopher, and Michael, the forgotten West Memphis Three. Bob, how much did Paradise Lost 1, 2, and 3 play a part into your look into the case? Was it any type of inspiration for selecting this case? Take us into the Bob Ruff world a little bit on why you chose the West Memphis 3.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because Paradise Lost, the entire trilogy, did play a big role in why I selected the case for Truth and Justice. but in a weird kind of way. You know, I study wrongful conviction cases because that's what I do for a living, right? So it's I always go into these big famous ones and study them just to look for, you know, patterns and things to look for, because we get hundreds of cases every month submitted to us to look at. And so I like to see, you know, what, you know, is there a jailhouse snitch involved? You know, is there not much physical evidence? Is there, you know, a potential wrongful or a false confession? There's a lot of little patterns that happen. So I was just watching the documentaries just to get an idea of what the case was about. And what inspired me actually to cover the case on Truth and Justice was actually the fact that after I watched the series and I was trying to talk to Mike, my producer and co-host, about it, I couldn't remember the names of the victims. And it bugged me a lot. And I really started to think about it. And I started to look, you know, to do a little more Googling and things. And I just found that all of the media attention always focused around the West Memphis Three, you know, Damian, Jason, and Jesse. And our show, we try to be very victim-centric, you know, and based on the victims, not only, you know, to try to give them a voice, but at the same time, that is, you know, critical to any real investigation. Should always start with a very thorough study of victimology to help develop a profile. And it just seemed like that was never done in this case. And certainly in the media, you know, while those documentaries were amazing, and so was West of Memphis, and they accomplished an amazing goal of freeing the West Memphis Three that never would have happened without them, I didn't feel like there was enough justice given to the victims. And that's why we named our season 5 on the podcast and the TV series The Forgotten West Memphis Three, because they seem to have gotten lost in a lot of the shuffle.
What do you think you learn by studying these three victims?
Well, the biggest thing that I learned by studying them is that my perception and the perception of, I'll say, casual observers of the case, because there are certainly people that have been digging into like documents for decades now, but the general consensus always seemed to be that there were three boys who were just out playing, having a great afternoon, and then they ended up kind of stumbling into however they were killed. You know, and of course, back in the, you know, the 90s, with the satanic panic, they assumed they stumbled into a satanic ritual killing. But then, you know, then later it became they stumbled into something else, or they look at like the Bojangles man, or, you know, maybe it was some, you know, some transient trucker or somebody. But what I found when I studied the victimology, I was shocked. And you know, we spent, I think, 3 full hour episodes going through the 140 page door to door notes in the case from the canvassing after the bodies were found. And what I found when we start to piece all of those sightings together is that the boys actually weren't together most of the day. First of all, you know, you had Stevie and Michael were together for a minute or for a little while, and then Christopher was alone, and then maybe Christopher and Michael and Stevie was gone. There's definitely a big gap in time when Stevie was missing in action, which is when I believe he actually returned to his house for a short time. And, you know, and then they only got together right before they went into the woods. And then of course, the revelation we find in the notes that one of Chris's friends reported that Chris straight told him that, you know, he was upset because his daddy whipped him and that he was running away. And so the thing that I learned most was that these boys didn't stumble into anything. They were running away from something, and that dramatically changes the course of the investigation.
Now, obviously, you are covering this case many, many years after the fact, but when the initial documentary was planned to do the first Paradise Lost, and they received permission to film or record both of the trials that were to take place, the documentarians went in there with the idea that these three teenagers were guilty. Like, that was a juicy enough story in itself. And then once they're viewing the trials, they start hearing the evidence and the eyewitness testimony and so on and so forth. And they start going, well, there's something that's not right here. This doesn't appear to be the actual case. And then, of course, Paradise Lost turns into almost this movement to try to free the West Memphis Three. When you went into this, and of course, we understand it was years later, but did you go into it with the idea of, okay, these guys are completely innocent, or maybe Mark Byers had something to do with this, or Terry Hobbs, or, I mean, did you go into this with anything prior thought of what knowledge you had of the case, or did you not really have an opinion of it at all until you started looking into it?
Oh, I definitely had an opinion, but I tried to approach it from a really unbiased perspective, because now both of you guys, I know, definitely Captain. I don't know, Nick, were you a big fan? It's not the right word, but were you really interested in the case for years to come, or was that more just Captain's thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's always been one of my, pet cases, I guess. It's one that's so easy to get sucked into. Actually just knowing that we were going to talk today pulled me right back in. I mean, it's one of the most fascinating cases out there.
Right. It really is. So when you watch, and I guess I'll ask you and Captain, because I want to know if I'm alone in this. After you watched, if you watch them in order, after you watch part two of the Paradise Lost series, who did you think was probably the most likely suspect?
So that's what's so interesting to me about Paradise 1 and 2 is, and I might have had a different opinion after watching the first one than maybe most. I watched that first one on HBO when I was a kid, I don't know how many times, and I always walked away from the first one going, you know what? I actually think these three teenagers did it. And then, of course, you watch Paradise Lost 2, and it looks like Mark Byers, he just time and time again comes up looking guilty and more guilty, and that he was the one that did it. And of course, he's also this large, loud, imposing man. He's also an authority figure to Chris and the other boys as well. He might know the area. I mean, there's just so many reasons why you can go, all right, well, maybe he looks good for this.
Right. And that was exactly my experience. I was wondering, Captain, did you think the same after you watched part two?
Well, after I watched part one, my first thought was that I feel Jason Baldwin is very transparent. He's very believable in everything he's saying. I believe 100% that he had nothing to do with the crime. Then when you look at the confession with Jesse Miss Kelly, it doesn't really line up with what the crime actually was. But I could never get over the boogeyman comment from Damian Eccles.
At the end
of part one, he's like, well, now I'm going to be known as like the boogeyman of West Memphis, and kids are going to say, well, maybe Damien's under my bed or he's in the closet. And that to me didn't seem like something a innocent person would say.
Oh, for sure. I mean, really kind of spot on with what you think, Captain. When I watched part one, I thought maybe they're innocent. Definitely, I felt like Baldwin was innocent, but Damien I wasn't so sure about. And then after I watched part two, I was convinced that Mark Byers was the murderer. I mean, 100%. I remember coming in, because I watched these late. It was just 3 years ago. I remember coming to the office and telling Mike, I was like, dude, holy shit, this guy killed him. The adopted father killed him. I mean, he had his teeth removed and blah, blah, you know, all the different things from there. I was convinced after part two that it was Mark Byers. And that's, you know, that's kind of why I was, you know, when you asked if I had kind of an opinion, that swing from there, then of course, after three, everybody thinks Terry Hobbs did it, right? You know, that's kind of what they left you with. And then West of Memphis. And so for me, it was like, okay, I need to approach this from a completely unbiased perspective, because Joe Berlinger just fucked me up in three documentaries in a row. Because, you know, I didn't watch them as they came out. I watched all three of them back to back over the course of a week. And I watched, you know, based on the way they were produced, I went from thinking, oh, maybe they're guilty, Jason's probably innocent, to, oh my God, it has to be Mark Byers, it's obvious, to part three was like, oh no, it has to be Terry Hobbs, it's obvious. I was like, man, if I'm being swayed that much by the media, there's got to be a lot more to this case than the way they're presenting it. And so that really led me into taking a completely unbiased approach and try to look at the investigation, which is what we did in season five when we covered Truth in the West Memphis Three, is to go all the way back to ground zero and just basically start a brand new investigation and see where it leads us.
Well, I became a big fan of yours when you were covering Serial. And I really liked the approach that you took there, where you had a thought process, and then you kind of try to prove yourself wrong. And I always, mm-hmm. I always like taking that approach. But to me, West Memphis 3 is very similar to the Adnan Syed case, where people look at the case and we are presented from these documentaries, we're presented all this cast of characters, and people always see, like you said, are the teenage boys guilty? Yeah, or is it one of the stepfathers? And everybody seems to have strong opinions of the characters that are cast for us. It seems like not too many people look outside that cast of characters, and it seems like there's no new cast of characters in West Memphis 3 in the last 20 years.
Right. Well, when you see the I know we're recording this before you see the series, and you're airing it after, but hopefully you won't have that opinion after this weekend, because we have, you know, I hate to, you know, you're right in the term cast of characters. I don't, you know, it makes it seem like it's a story, but one of the things I wanted to do was get away from the sensational, you know, the cameras are always on Damien, right? And the, you know, through Paradise Lost, it's Damien and John Mark Byers are our key characters, and it's because they're the most interesting, right? When you're watching it, you know, you know, Damien is saying things like, "Well, I'm going to be the boogeyman under their bed," and Mark Byers is blowing up fucking pumpkins and you know, lighting bonfires at the Discovery site. But there's a lot more important characters, I think, that you've never seen on TV before. You've never seen it in the documentaries. You've never seen it anywhere. You know, we have, you know, I don't know how you want. Do you want me to mention? Do you want me to spoil some of what's coming up, since they're going to hear it after, or no?
Well, how about we just, since it's going that route, how about we just dive into some of the details of the case and get your opinion on some of those question marks? And if it comes up, it comes up. If it doesn't, we'll force you into it here at the end.
Sure.
I'd hate to spoil it too early in our discussion, because we got a lot of questions, a lot of things on our mind. It's rare for us. We think we know the case very well. We covered it on True Crime Garage a long time ago. It's way too big to cover it in just a few episodes. We tried in three, but all we really thought that we achieved was we pointed out a timeline that came from very credible sources and from police reports and eyewitness statements and so on and so forth, that seemed to indicate that it would have been very difficult, almost impossible, on the timeline for John Mark Byers to have committed the crime, especially by himself. We found a timeline that seemed to be that he was with somebody else and a whole different batch of people along the way, pretty much most of that evening and night. So I think the first thing, and this is really good for people that don't know the case very well, but we're excited to get to talk to you, because we feel you know this case really well, and that's why we want to get your opinions on these things. But for the people that don't know the case well, one thing I think the public may have trouble grasping, but they do need to understand, as it's very important to how things played out the way they did. So I think if you could kind of talk to this a little bit, but we need to have an understanding of the level of poverty here in regards to the three boys that were arrested for the murders, and in regards to the lifestyle of the three young victims, because the three that were arrested, they were extremely poor, unfortunately, and the three victims were a little more middle class. Could you talk and expand on that a bit?
Yeah, what's interesting really is that a little more middle class, I guess, is a good way to put it. But the entire, you know, Captain used the term cast of characters earlier, and if you look at it like that, the entire cast of characters here, they're all, you know, at the poverty line or below, including the victims' families. You know, so you have definitely the three convicted. You know, they're living in very low rent trailer parks, you know, and I've been out to these places. They haven't changed much since then. Definitely on the lower income scale. But even the three victims, you know, you had, you know, the buyers, you know, everybody was working, they had jobs and they were getting by, but these people definitely weren't thriving. And you had an interesting situation in just about every family. You know, you had, you know, we had on our show, we had Dawn Moore, who's Michael Moore's sister, who had never been interviewed before. And she was on the podcast during season five. And she gave us a whole new look into the household of the Moores, right? So their issue there seemed like it was alcoholism. She said, you know, both her mom and dad were alcoholics. It was an abusive situation. And so that wasn't the, you know, the picture I had when I was studying victimology of what that household looks like. You know, you go across the street to the Byers household and, you know, again, they're getting by, but they struggle a little bit financially. And you have some drug addiction, both on Chris Byers' mother's part and his adoptive father. And then you go down to the Stevie Branch's household, the Hobbs household. You know, you had Pam and Terry were both working. They seemed on the surface to be the most stable, but then we find out later that there's possibly or allegedly some abuse that's going on there, and then also maybe some drug use down there as well. So you had nobody was in good shape, so to speak, as far as in their household. Either they're struggling financially, they're struggling with substance abuse, or they're struggling with physical abuse in all of these different communities. But definitely the three that were convicted, Damian, Jason, and Jesse, they were throwaways for sure. And when I say that, I mean that they were, as you said, they were extremely poor, much more so than the three victims. And once they were targeted by police, whether they actually believed they did it or if they were in fact targeted, that's up for speculation. But once they were targeted, there was nobody there to fight for them. They didn't have any money. They didn't have lawyers. They just, you know, they were throwaways. There were people that I think the powers that be, and particularly the West Memphis Police Department, thought, you know, we can lock these people up, close this case, everybody's going to be happy, and no one really cares what happened to these three kids.
Well, I'm back to one of the things you were saying before, that when you're looking at the victimology, like you said, it changes from here's these three boys hanging out and they stumble upon something. As you were saying, you were getting into the idea that they're running from something. What evidence did you find? Could you find evidence to back that up?
Yeah, well, I mean, a big part of it is the fact that we find some weird anomalies throughout the sightings of them throughout the day, where they're not together, they disappear. And then when we study, so let's look at Stevie Branch in particularly. Stevie was probably the most well-behaved of the three, based on what we see from, you know, school reports. You know, we had, sounds like, you know, what we would call today, Chris Byers and Michael Moore both suffered from ADHD, which I can relate to. I have a 9-year-old that has the same issue, tend to be a little more mischievous. But, you know, Stevie was a rule follower, and he pretty much stayed out of trouble. And he was told that he needed to be home by, you know, 4:30, 4:45. And so you had to believe that he's going to do his best to make that happen. And then the sightings seem to indicate that that did happen. You know, they disappeared. And then there's some medical evidence that Stevie has partially digested green vegetable-like food in his stomach. Well, that can only occur for about an hour, hour and a half before it moves past that stage in the stomach, which means somewhere along the lines he went and ate some vegetables, which would be a good indication that he did go home. But then he left again. So then why is he leaving? Now, we don't know, but it seems like, and then if you take Jamie Clark Ballard's statement, which, you know, I don't necessarily think is entirely credible, but she reports that she sees Terry yelling at him to get back down there. And just the fact that Stevie leaves again after dinner, and then what we learn later in his victimology study that we have, there has been reported abuse from his stepdad, Terry Hobbs, and that's come from some family members, but also in people that I've interviewed outside of the family have told us the same thing, that, you know, that they were always kind of afraid for Stevie because of some beatings that he would take from Terry. So there's some indications with Stevie. Christopher is easier. Because he literally went to the kid's name is Bobby Posey's house in the door-to-door notes, and I've spoken with Bobby Posey. We hear from him in the TV series, you know, and he goes to tell Bobby that his daddy had just whipped him and that he's running away. So there's no, we don't have to speculate about if Chris Byers was running away, because he told his friends that he was running away. We have other witnesses that we hear from in the TV series that say that they saw them with sleeping bags heading towards the woods. And Michael Moore was always kind of the leader of the group. There's not so much with him as far as direct evidence, other than some things his sister told us about, you know, the situation in the household and some potential abuse that could have been happening in the household. Again, that's according to her. That's not verifiable, so I would say alleged abuse that happens in the household. So all that together, and then with the sightings that put them in different places at different times, and then kind of coming together, and then going to a place where they know they're not supposed to be, and the fact that Stevie would go there when he really knows he's supposed to be at home at that point, those are all great indicators that they were running away from something. They weren't just in that scary woods across the pipe just to play.
And one of the victims, was it Michael Moore that was known to be afraid of those woods?
Chris Byers. Yeah, he was terrified of the woods, according to to Mark Byers and to his brother, who we also hear from in the TV series.
So what you're saying is it's not just one of the victims that was, quote-unquote, running away, but possibly all three of them, or friends trying to help their friend out. Your dad whooped you. You can't take this anymore. I'll help you out. I'll run away with you.
Yeah, you know, this is kind of somewhat speculation on my part, but my theory is that it's kind of a Stand By Me type of deal. You know, where the kids are kind of rising up against the grownups and taking matters into their own hands. I think that, you know, and again, this is my theory, is that Chris was fed up and running away. I think that something. I think that Stevie, I'll be honest with you, I think Stevie did go home and eat, and I think that he left and he was scared, and I think that Michael more than likely was the one that said, hey, because we have note in the door-to-door notes, Michael actually told a little girl that lived up near the pipe bridge that he's going to go over to the other side of the bridge to the woods behind Mayflower to his secret hideout. So I think Michael becomes the kind of the savior, the leader that says, you know, the other two are they want to run away and get away from their parents. And Michael says, well, here, I know a spot. Let me lead the way, and takes him over there.
And John Mark Byers, he admits that he hit Chris that day, that afternoon, that he disciplined him.
Right. Yeah.
And then we have, hold on. I'm kind of trying to digest all this as we go through this here. So that's what I find very interesting, at least about the Robin Hood Hills portion of it. Like, do you believe that the boys were killed at Robin Hood Hills? I mean, from the autopsy, it appears that two of the boys drowned. So, of course, two of them likely died there. But this is a pretty brutal attack. Do you think that from the evidence that we see, that you've reviewed anyway, did this all take place in Robin Hood Hills?
100%. I don't think there's any. There's a million theories out there, but after the thorough studying we've done of the case and then the new team of experts we brought in for the TV series, it seems. As a matter of fact, Dr. Rebecca Hsu, that was our new forensic pathologist that came in and looked at the autopsy. You know, her determination was that all three boys died of drowning. That you know, there were some other injuries, a couple of head injuries, but basically all of the brutality that we see on the boys was all postmortem animal activity. This was not as complicated as a crime as we think. But the another big misconception is for people that, and you know, I in one of our episodes I just mentioned, it's funny that my perception of those woods and where the boys' bodies were found mostly came from the movie adaptation of Marl Everett's book, The Devil's Knot, when we see I'm sure you guys have probably seen that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, at the beginning when it shows them riding their bikes and they go around the barrier and go into the woods, and it shows them going through this remote forest back to this creek in the middle of this huge forest. Well, that's where I thought this thing occurred, the crime occurred. But the reality of it is, this was a tiny little patch of woods about the size of a football field. You can literally, I've done it, I've stood there and done it, stand in the backyard of a house on the other side of the bayou and throw a rock to the place where the boys' bodies were found. I mean, this crime occurred right in the middle of, there's an operating truck wash to the west, there's a major interstate to the north, to the south is the Mayfair Apartments, and then there's a row of houses with backyards but right up to the bayou. So the idea that this could have occurred anywhere besides there is really, in my opinion, preposterous, because that means, I mean, this is where the search efforts are focused, right? Not necessarily across the pipe, but in the Robin Hood Woods just south of the bayou, south of the pipe. Some people were in the woods north of the pipe where the bodies were actually found. So the idea that if someone killed these boys or captured them somewhere else and they need to either A, hide the bodies or go, you know, take them somewhere else to finally kill them, that they would just, that the place they would choose is this tiny little patch of woods where the only way you can get to it is either to park on the highway and walk in, to park at the truck wash and walk in, or walk across the pipe bridge in front of the Mayfair Apartments carrying these bodies to conceal them right in the heart of the search efforts is bananas. There's just no way that would have happened. I think the only reason the boys' bodies were concealed where they were found is because that's where the crime occurred. And once it happened, I think that the individual, and I do think it was a single individual, once the boys were dead, they knew I've got to hide these bodies and I need to create distance. I've got to make sure nobody finds these bodies at least long enough for me to get out of here and then appear to be doing something else. That's the only reason I think the bodies were concealed where they were, is because there was no other choice. No one's going to choose that spot. It's a terrible, it couldn't be a worse place to choose to dispose of a body when that's where everybody's looking for those boys, especially considering a mile down the road is the Mississippi River and there's a million places you could drop those bodies and they'd never be seen again.
So you were saying, and I hope I got this correct, but you were talking about that there's evidence that Stevie ate something before the crime occurred.
Yeah. So in the autopsy, there is a notation that says the other. So the boys from their parents reported that none of them had eaten since their meal in school, their lunch, you know, 11, 12 o'clock in the afternoon or 12 o'clock. Well, so Christopher and Michael's stomach contents are empty, which is what you would expect. It takes, you know, there's a range of time, but for, you know, active 8-year-old boys with healthy metabolisms, the average is like an hour and a half to 2 hours. It takes for food to move, you know, to become digested and move out of the stomach or lumen, as it's noted in the autopsy, into the intestines. So Stevie, when they open up his stomach, there's quite a bit of what they call partially digested green vegetables in his stomach, which means, so he, you know, I believe that our window of when the boys were killed is between 6:30 and 7:30 p.m., which would mean, so on the front end of that 6:30, if you go back hour and a half, 2 hours, that means that no earlier than 4:30, Stevie had to have eaten some vegetables. And it could have been as late as 5:30, 6 o'clock even, that he ate some vegetables.
Do you think his family members are just misremembering, or do you think it's more nefarious on stating he never ate anything?
I don't think it's nefarious on saying he never ate anything, but the issue is, so he leaves at 3:30, right, with Michael Moore, mm-hmm. Is when Michael comes down, they get in their bikes and go. And so the issue is, even if Pam Hobbs is, or Pam Hicks now, is incorrect, she says he didn't eat any snacks, he didn't eat anything after school. Let's say she's wrong, and let's say he decided to eat some broccoli as a snack after school. That still, because it's 3:30 is the time he leaves, if he never returns home again, by 5:30, that food's gone from his stomach. So even if she's wrong about that, it still wouldn't be partially digested in his stomach. You know what I mean? So at some point, he had to return. So I believe, I'll say this, that I'm very, very confident in stating, I 100% believe that Stevie Branch, contrary to what's been stated by his stepfather at the time, Terry Hobbs, I believe absolutely that he did at some point after 5 o'clock return home and eat. and then he left again. Now, I do not know if Terry was there and knows that he did that. So I'm not saying that Terry's lying in the fact that he said that he never returned home and ate. I don't know that. But what I do know, or I feel very confident in saying, is that Stevie did, in fact, return home and eat at some point and then leave again.
And in fairness to the victims' families, it's my understanding that they weren't properly interviewed. From my understanding, actually, it may appear even in 1993, a couple of them were not sat down and, you know, they didn't participate in a thorough interview.
Oh, that's 100% correct. And that's another part of why I decided to take the case, because I feel like if we go back to the beginning and do this thing right, that maybe the answer's been there all along if we do a proper investigation. And that's why we took it on the podcast and the TV series. But as I mentioned, you know, that starts with a proper investigation, starts with victimology. And then you start with the people closest to the victims and you work your way out in concentric circles. That was never done in this case. So Mark Byers was interviewed multiple times, gave recorded interviews, but that was because he went to the police. He's the one that initiated that. Pam Hobbs was spoken to a couple times. You have cursory conversations with Dana Moore and Melissa Byers. Todd Moore was never interviewed by police, and Terry Hobbs was never interviewed by police at all. Not like a little bit, at all. Which is baffling that they would, and it's because they jumped to a conclusion. They jumped to an assumption when they saw the boys come out and they saw how mutilated their bodies were, which we now know was due to animal activity, but that back then they didn't know. And they decided this was that satanic ritual killing they knew was coming. Damien Eccles is the kid that would do something like this. And they got such tunnel vision that they never did the basic steps of a proper investigation, including not just not interviewing the family, but in the door-to-door canvassing, they never even went door-to-door in Stevie Branch's neighborhood at all. Not his neighbors, no one around there. We know now, Pat, Captain had asked earlier about evidence indicating that they are actually running from something. You know, we know now that Stevie was seen by a woman named Betty Johnson on 16th Street riding his bike south that afternoon alone. That's one of the reasons we know that he went home. The only reason we know that wasn't because of the West Memphis Police Department. It was because of a newspaper reporter that started knocking on doors in that area asking people if they'd seen the boys. And she said, yeah, I saw Stevie by himself on his bike riding south on 16th Street that afternoon. The police had no idea that happened because they never asked anybody in the area.
Tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I've seen where there were sightings of, you know, one boy, two boys,
mm-hmm.
three boys on their bikes, and possibly even four boys on their bikes. And a lot of people think that fourth boy could have been Vicky Hutchinson's son.
Right. Which I don't believe that, by the way.
But did you see any reports of four boys together?
Yeah, there were a few reports with four boys together. As a matter of fact, in our timeline that we put together based on all those door-to-door notes, I show that I called him Mystery Boy, but there, you know, one of the big sightings was when Narlene Hollingsworth sees the boy and sees, you know, she says she sees three boys on bikes. And so people think, oh, it's the West Memphis, it's the three boys, except for Chris didn't have a bike, especially not at that time in the afternoon. He wasn't on a bike. So that third boy is actually a fourth boy, and she describes him as being heavy set with dark hair. Well, that doesn't describe either of any of the three victims. They were all thin. So that sighting, along with a few others, is who, you know, we deemed Mystery Boy, and you actually hear from, you know, we figured out who that was and actually interviewed him on the TV series, who the Mystery Boy was. And then there's another, you know, other sightings where there's four boys going into the woods right before they're killed. So there's another potential fourth boy. But I don't think that it's – I mean, well, for starters, as I said, we know who that fourth boy was now. But I've never believed it was Aaron Hutchison, because the evidence – now, it's been a little while. You may know more about it than me now, because it's been a couple of years since I've studied it. But it seemed to be pretty clear that Aaron Hutchison went home that day after school. He wasn't – and he didn't live in that neighborhood. He lived out in the trailer park. So he wasn't even around that afternoon.
Right, and he gives dozens of different stories as to what he says he witnessed or saw when he supposedly saw the kids being killed.
Right, which is it's awful what the police did to that poor boy. You know, what they put him through.
And I mean, he names different suspects in each one of the stories too. The suspects don't even remain the same. And then he says certain things took place on the victims or to the victims that we know just by the autopsies did not occur at all. Regarding the timeline that you're piecing together, one thing that's always stood out is that Pam Hobbs, you said now Pam Hicks, her and Terry Hobbs's timeline for that night never really seemed to match up 100%. It's my understanding that Pam Hobbs worked that evening and that Terry drove her to her place of employment and then picked her up at the end of her shift that evening. With your movement of Stevie Branch, do we have him leaving their house, if he fact it did return to the Hobbs household, do we have him leaving before Pam goes off to work, before Terry has to drive her to work?
No, I don't think there's any question that he hadn't returned yet before Pam went to work. I mean, that is pretty obvious from Pam's statements herself that, you know, she was upset because Stevie wasn't there, that Terry was upset when he got home because Stevie wasn't home when he was supposed to be. They left, and then she first finds out something had happened when Terry picks her up from work. I don't see any, you know, I'll say this. I believe her 100% that that's what happened. There's no reason for her to lie about that. And sadly, we all saw Pam's reaction when she found out what happened to Stevie. You know, it was on, you know, the news. It was on the Paradise Lost series. I don't think Stevie, I think that was the issue. I think that, personally, this, and again, I'm giving you a theory here, but I believe that Terry and Pam left to take Pam to work, and Stevie probably ended up coming home shortly thereafter. You know, kind of missed him, and then the question is, did Terry ever come home then after he dropped Pam off and have some interaction or communication with Stevie, or did Stevie leave again before Terry got back?
Now, when you watch these documentaries, and when you study the case, I'll keep going with our theme of characters, which character were you most interested in, and what do you think you learned by talking to them?
As a suspect or as a, like, a personality?
Well, not as a suspect, but just anybody, as far as the documentaries go. I mean, like, if I was, you know, I rewatched Paradise Lost 1, 2, and 3 recently, and I'd go, if I could talk to anybody, I'd like to talk to Damien. I'd like to talk to Terry Hobbs. I'd like to talk to Mark Byers. Those are the first three individuals I'd want to interview.
Right. Yeah. And I've interviewed all, well, I haven't interviewed Terry, but I don't know if I can point one out, but I guess I can walk through a few of those, like you mentioned. So Damien, I really like Damien. You know, when I went to go meet him at first and interview him, I was surprised to find out that he's a pretty normal guy, you know, because he's, you know, his character so that we've seen on TV and kind of his character we see in his social media and stuff like that. You know, he's into this ceremonial magic stuff, which seems very mystic and very artsy. But, you know, I've sat around talking about football with Damien. Anytime I'm in New York, I usually try to catch up with him and Lori, and we'll go out for pizza. And, you know, last time we were there, we went to a pizza place, Damien's favorite place. We had pizza. We hung out for a couple hours. And then he took me to a place called Insomnia Cookies because he swore they had the best cookies in the world, and they were the best cookies in the world. And so I guess what was interesting to find out with him is that Damien's a normal guy. Like he's interested in something that a lot of people don't necessarily relate with, which is, you know, his, I don't even call it a faith or religion, but his, that ceremonial magic that he's into. But, you know, regardless whether you can relate with that or not, he's a very personable, very normal guy. Doesn't like talking about the case, just likes just chatting about life. And I enjoy Damien's company when I'm around him. Jason Baldwin, it's kind of surprised me the other way. He seemed like very much a vanilla kind of character. But then when I went down and actually met with him and we went out to lunch and then interviewed in person, he's full of fire. Actually, we just, I don't know if you listened to it, if either one of you guys did, but we just aired two episodes of an interview I did with Jason back in 2018 that nobody had heard before. And he's got fire in his eyes that I didn't know was there.
He seems extremely interested in finding out who actually did this.
Very much so.
Of the three, where to me it feels like Damien is more involved with his causes. I think he's involved with the innocent people being on death row, or I don't know the name of it offhand, but he seems to be very driven toward that, where Baldwin seems fully invested in finding out who did this, clearing his name. And he's one of those people that, I mean, the interview is great, but you know, the captain and I have always kind of thought this, if Jason and Damien would have been tried separately and Jason would have been tried first, we find it very difficult that they would have found him guilty. A lot of that based off of his character and his personality, and of course that there just was no evidence. But to hear your interviews with him really takes his character, as you said, to the extreme, because he does seem very vanilla on the surface. But when he starts talking about the case or talking about things that were going on in West Memphis at the time that they were charged with the crimes, he's fascinating, and two, he's very dialed into what he was doing. And I found his very detailed alibi to be incredibly, one, interesting and incredibly believable.
Yeah, I agree on all counts. I agree, and especially the fact that if he wasn't tried with Damien, I think he for sure would have been acquitted. You know, he was collateral damage, really.
Well, and I think that's one thing that gets lost in the shuffle there, is that we have Jesse Miskelly, who gives this bad confession. He's offered a bit of a reduced sentence because they want him to testify against Baldwin and Eccles at trial. One, simply just to introduce the confession to that trial. He says, look, I'm not going to testify against them, basically because it's not true. And then Baldwin gets the opportunity to testify against Eccles, and he turns it down as well, where that shows something to the character of these still very young men, these teenagers at the time.
You know, there's a lot of meta that you see in the documentaries when that part, when the trial's happening in Paradise Lost 1, and Baldwin's reaction to when his attorney, I think it was Paul Ford, asks him after Damien had testified on camera, he asked Jason, so do you think that he's guilty? And if you watch that scene right there is what convinced me that Jason Baldwin has no clue what actually happened. Cause you could see it in his eyes that he was thinking. And then I think his response was, you know, they sure made him seem like he did. And it was like, holy shit, he really doesn't know. That kid does not know who killed those boys.
Yeah, he does not know, and he's thinking it through, because you see it's almost his reaction. You can read his mind, and it's like he wasn't with Damien that evening. He wasn't with Eccles that
right.
evening, so he doesn't. He's kind of clueless as to, he's not asked, did you and Eccles do this together? He's just asked, did Damien Eccles do this? And he's going, well, they sure made him look guilty. You almost see that he is about to say, well, I don't know. And I think he was smart enough to go, well, they sure made him look guilty, because that I don't know statement would have just been an odd one for the argument against Damien anyway.
Yeah. And it just, to me, it was like, I could see, you know, for me, I would see in his mind him thinking, Jesus Christ, did he do it? Like maybe he did. I don't know. I wasn't with him. You know, maybe he did do it. I don't know. They made him seem like he did. But, you know, again, like for me, what I'm looking at is not necessarily what that means for Damien, but what does it mean for Jason? And it was like, obviously he didn't have anything to do with it, which again, is just one more thing that even if that was the case, if it was just that Jason was innocent, it just, again, tears the state's case down, their entire theory down, because it was supposed to be them together, and the confession had all of them together.
Well, and how did Baldwin's alibi fall apart?
Doesn't
he claim that he went with a different friend that's not really known to most of the people that have taken a quick look at the case? He went with a different friend to cut his uncle's lawn, and then correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm going off of memory here, but I believe that he and the friend went and did something afterward, and Baldwin is saying, hey, I remember this date because I sold him a cassette tape that day, and that, you know, as we discussed already, these kids are dirt poor. He remembers that day because he probably did a chore that may have earned him some money. And if he didn't get paid from the uncle, he at the very least received some money for that cassette tape from his friend.
Yeah. Yeah. The friend that was with him was Ken Watkins. And I think the issue is that alibi was, and I'm working from memory too on this part of it, you know, cause when I did the case and I looked at, okay, if I take this investigation from the beginning and do it properly, where does it take us? Well, the problem with that is it never takes you anywhere near the direction of the West Memphis Three. So we had to kind of force that in to go like, okay, well, let's see how they got here and why. So I've never really focused a whole lot on their trial since then. But if memory serves, it had to do with the fact that when they questioned Ken Watkins, because Jason tells his lawyers that, yeah, I was with Ken Watkins after the lawn mowing. Damien left with Dominie. And then Ken and I went to Walmart and we played video games. And then he said, yeah, you should. There was an Asian kid there, too. You should ask him, whose name ended up being Don Nam, was the Asian kid that was there. And he's like, these guys can verify my alibi. But then, you know, months and months and months later, when Watkins and Nam get interviewed before trial, they don't confirm his alibi. They either don't remember it or they don't give the right information. I don't remember the details exactly about it, but basically, they didn't corroborate what Jason had said, so I don't think they ever ended up testifying.
Well, just to play a little bit of a devil's advocate here, after I watched Paradise Lost 1, I started thinking, well, is it as simple as they had Damien on a list, and that's it? And they just went with this, and this kid had long black hair, listen to heavy metal, and he's kind of a freak show, and we believe that this was done by a freak show. Or is there a little bit more to it? Like you said, if you investigate it properly, then you're going through the proper channels, but you're still going to have a juvenile officer come forward and say, look, out of all the people in the town that I think possibly could have done this, here's a kid's name on the list that you might want to look into.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that, like, that's fucking crazy. I mean, you know what I mean? Imagine in your town there's a murder and the entire investigation is based on some dude's hunch. Like, oh, I know a guy that would do this. You know, it's crazy.
No, but I still think that's reason to look into an individual. And then when you hear statements that this individual also, which maybe he said it, maybe he didn't, you know, at a softball game, saying that he killed these two boys and that he was going to kill more, or two more before he was done.
Yeah,
I think it's reasonable to believe that you should look into this individual.
Yeah, I'll give you that. I think that, you know, if someone's got this hunch, or at least when that information comes forward, like the softball information, sure, you look at him, but then there's a big chicken and egg problem with Damien too, in the fact, like, say that statement at the softball, whether it happened or not. Yeah, I tend to think that maybe some version of it did happen, but it's because I think it's because, you know, he was targeted, he was interviewed within hours of the boys being found, he was harassed. The police were asking all of his friends, all of his family. They were calling him in repeatedly, to the point where this rebellious teenager is like, screw these guys, you know? And so Damien says he doesn't really remember that happening. And he says he certainly wouldn't have confessed to something he didn't do, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibilities if he was at a game or whatever there and, you know, somebody's like, dude, I heard that you did it. And he's like, oh, yeah, I did it. I killed them and I'm going to kill some more. Similar to his boogeyman comment. But certainly once that you hear that, that you heard this guy confess to it, yeah, you interview him. But would he ever – would any of that have happened if they weren't offering rewards to a bunch of poor people and harassing Damien and spreading the word around town that it was Damien who did it? Then would any of these statements have ever come out? I personally don't think they ever would have. I think if they took this case and they waited until they had the proper medical evaluation and said, okay, these kids were hit over the head, drowned, and buried there. Okay, so that's every indication there is that this is someone with a known personal relationship to the boys. The FBI was offering to help with profiling. So let's go interview, and they should have already done so. Let's interview every single parent, every brother, every neighbor, and let's start piecing things together. And I think that if you I'm dancing here, but if you started at the center and worked your way out, very quickly the person or people whose alibis don't check out, that aren't where they said they were, that have unaccounted for time and behavior would have become very apparent very quickly. We're in this mess we're in now 27 years later because that was never done. And if you do that, I think that you never end up even if some juvenile probation officer is like, well, I think that Damien Eccles was a Satanist. Well, if you waited for the proper evidence, you know that there was nothing about this crime scene that indicated it was a satanic ritual whatsoever.
Well, and there was – what's weird about that statement of, oh, I heard Damien Eccles say this at a softball game or whatever. I think it was in Mara Leverett's book, The Devil's Knot, where there's some evidence to suggest that even at times maybe investigators were going around town with a photograph of Damien Eccles, and they're asking individuals about the case if they know anything about the murders, and they're also showing this photograph. That's almost implying that this man, this boy, is in somehow connected to the murders themselves. And you can almost see a situation where, because he knows he's being looked at and he's being harassed during this whole time, that he's overheard discussing that with somebody and they misconstrue it completely. And you point out something that's very, very big here is the reward. All these people are poor, and now we got this money sitting on a table up for grabs. If you have any information, tell us, and let's put these devil worshipers behind bars, and here's your pot of gold. That money was never officially paid out to anyone that we know of, right?
Yeah, no one knows where it went. They've been able to keep that pretty tight-lipped.
It might have went to Vicky Hutchinson. Who knows? Question for you. You said something that I find very interesting. A lot of people that think that the West Memphis Three are guilty of this crime, a lot of people will cite that, well, this is a crime that couldn't have been done by one individual. And you stated earlier that you believe it was done by a single individual. What makes you believe that?
There's a lot of things that have to do with the profile of the crime scene. You know, we've worked with Jim Clemente doing crime scene reconstruction and studying the behavior exhibited here. And my own analysis was the same. People think that how would one person kill three boys? But that's part of why the profile indicates that this is someone not only with a known personal relationship, but also an authority figure to these 8-year-old boys, which is pretty much any adult, right? It's very easy to see, say, one boy gets punished, and which results in him being unconscious, and the other boy's freaking out, and for that single figure to yell, you know, get your butts back here, or come back, or I'm going to do this, or whatever, and you could literally, you know, I've said this before on the podcast, that, you know, as a grown man myself, I could easily grab three 8-year-old boys by the, you know, by the naps of their neck, by the collars of their shirt, you know, one in one hand and two in the other, and grab them and hold them underwater, all three at the same time. You know, it's not, you know, I've wrestled around with my boy and his friends. You know, it's definitely not necessary for there to be three. the forensics and the crime scene seem to indicate that there was one, you know, that, that it's the same kind of patterns happening on all of them. People like to cite, well, this knot was tied differently than this knot, but they were all a series of half hitch knots, basically. You know, some of them were double, triple, whatever, but it's basically the same type of knot. The boys are all tied up in the same way. You just don't see that that happen with three different people, right? So the boys were tied up in a very unique way with ankles to wrists.
So what you're stating is with the knots, the knots were the same type of knots. It's just sometimes there were multiple knots instead of just a single.
Yeah, so a half hitch knot is a basic, like the first knot you tie in your shoes, you know, over under and pull it tight.
Yeah.
And you know, a double knot and a triple knot and a quadruple knot. They're all different variations of that knot. But what's more important
right.
is to look at the very unique way of how the boys were tied. Right ankle to right wrist, left ankle to right wrist. That was done. You know, no one would direct someone to tie them in that particular way because there's no utility in it, right? It doesn't stop someone from running. It doesn't keep them from being able to untie themselves. It's not hog tying, like some would say. It's pretty clearly this was done post mortem, or at least post, you know, when someone's unconscious. I think Michael Moore did show a little bit of bruising from one of the ligatures, which could mean he still had some amount of heartbeat left when that was put on, but the others show none. So, you know, if there's multiple people and you're directing them, you know, do you say, hey, when you tie them up, make sure you tie right wrist to right ankle, left wrist to right ankle? You wouldn't do that. You know, you're trying to tie them up. In my opinion, the reason they were tied that way was to create a smaller package to keep them under the water. So that they didn't reveal themselves. I think it was probably a trial and error. I think they were probably put down. It didn't work. And then they took the clothes off and tied them up that way. But that's kind of really getting into the weeds. But the point is, in my opinion, looking at that crime scene, the same person tied all three of those boys up. The same person put all three boys into the water and the clothes. Everything is too uniform for there to have been multiple people there. And also, I mean, plain and simple, two people can't keep a secret like this for that long. It's impossible. The only way a secret like this gets kept is if only one person knows what happened.
All right. Thank you guys so much for joining us in the garage. We know it's difficult times. Weird times, strange times, and we appreciate you. And we're going to keep going with the Flying Garage Ship.
And if you want to listen to our coverage of the West Memphis 3, download the free Stitcher app. We have all of our shows on there. And you can go all the way back to July of 2016. Listen to episodes 40, 41, and 42. Those are the West Memphis 3 episodes. Also, we've talked about West Memphis 3 I don't know how many times on our other show, Off the Record, available on Stitcher Premium. Go to our website and you can click on Off the Record and get a free month of listening. Until tomorrow, be good, be kind, and don't litter.